From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on July 1st, 1980, Phoenix, Arizona. A young photographer named William Snyder was interning for the Arizona Republic, and that night he was handed a thrilling assignment. William was told to go photograph The Who in concert on the campus of Arizona State. He was hoping to hear his favorite song, Eminence Front, and many others. But halfway through the show, the power went out. The band was about ready to leave after about 20 minutes. But the power went back on, and we got a little more of this. You know, in many ways, the fact that the power came on just in time kind of changed the course of William's life, because not only did he get to shoot the band, he went backstage after that show, he talked to Pete Townsend for 45 minutes about music, life on the road, and the seed planted that night ended up later becoming a friendship. William Snyder has gone on to win 4 Pulitzer Prizes, and our past conversations on the show have focused on his work covering politics, major world events. He's worked for the Dallas Morning News. He's won just about all of the major photography awards, it seems. But during his career, he also became a kind of personal photographer of The Who. RIT is getting ready to show off an exhibit called William Snyder, Picturing The Who. And we thought it would be fun to take a brief respite from the national political coverage to talk about the craft of photographing great music. And William told me, please don't play Eminence Front. That was the one thing he'd wanted. And you know, the second you told me that, it was a fait accompli. That's the opening music just for you.
Yeah, well, you know. No, I love that song, but it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere now. Pete has a guy who is placing the music in films and commercials and all sorts of things. And he's done an excellent job with Eminence Front. And as I told him, I'm really getting tired of that song. But let me, as long as we're doing this, let me be clear. When I saw them in 1980, Eminence Front had not been written yet.
So that wasn't even out yet. Yeah.
No, it was not.
By 93 it was.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, that was what, 80... 3 or 4, something like that.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, it was 83. I think it was on their last album.
Yep. So, but anyway, well, William told me, please, no Eminence Front. And I thought, that's perfect for the opening. Thank you very much. No, see, before we dive in on The Who, by the way, and there's a lot to talk about here that should be a lot of fun, we hope, this hour. You know, I thought maybe you'd rather just spend the rest of the hour talking about comparing photographs of past inaugurations to this inauguration.
Oh.
Are we in the weirdest political time ever? I mean, that's the photographic talk is on comparing pictures of inaugurations and crowd size.
Oh, geez. Well, I mean, yeah, I think we've gone through the looking glass. You know, I've been a political junkie, news junkie since I was a kid. I grew up, quote unquote, in the 60s. I mean, I was a preteen in the 60s, but I had an older sister and an older brother who were interested in those things, so I knew what was going on. You know, I was one of those people, and at the risk of offending some of your listeners, I hated Nixon, and you know, was a Democratic supporter, and now I see this. I don't know what to tell you. Who are you going to believe? You know, him or your lying eyes? I have friends that made some of those pictures that they've talked about, you know, that show the crowds, and people want to argue about, oh, when they were shot and were they photoshopped. And, you know, it really annoys me because it calls into question their honesty and their professionalism. And I'm offended by that. I mean, these are professional people that have worked very, very hard to achieve the kind of status and the kind of quality and the trust that their agencies, whether it's a newspaper or a wire service, have in them to cover politics in the most honest, open, unbiased way that they possibly can. For example, that picture taken from the Washington Monument that lots of people dispute was taken by an acquaintance of mine. And you know, that picture's taken every inauguration. It wasn't just taken this time to sort of smack him in the face or anything. It's taken every single inauguration as far as I know. And, you know, of course, people in the news are going to look back and say, oh, look at the difference. And, you know, I don't know how you argue with that. There's video that kind of shows sort of the same thing. I don't know how you argue with that. So it's one thing for him to stand up there and say that. That's crazy enough. But for perhaps millions of people to also side with that and argue about it, I just don't know.
Yeah, and so do you think there is something different about this? I ask that, William, because a lot of the conversation about this administration is, well, this feels different. This isn't just an example of X or Y or Z. That this feels a bridge too far. That the first full day in office, they've got their press secretary bringing out photos saying, no, trust these instead. Does that feel different to you, or do you feel like we have seen this kind of thing before?
I think it's very different because it's focusing on things that don't really matter. You want the president to be presidential, as he said he promised he would do, and you expect him or her to focus on the really important issues at hand, not the size of the crowd, not the size of the march and all of those things. That stuff's going to happen if you're a president. No matter where you are on the political spectrum, there are always going to be people that don't agree with you and are going to march against you. I think the biggest thing here is, unlike we've ever seen in the past, even during the Nixon era, there is this notion of only we can tell you the truth. And that's really scary, that the media is not to be trusted, that all they do, the mainstream media, all they do is lie. And, you know, what was it Bannon said the other day? I mean, the media needs to shut up and listen. And I can't remember what representative it was or congressman said, you know, you need to just listen to Trump and get the information straight from the horse's mouth. I mean, the guy's a real estate salesman. That's what he is. He sells real estate, ultimately. Now, again, there'll probably be listeners that'll be offended by this. But think about this. You know, when you're sort of messing with someone, what do you always say? Well, I've got some land I want to sell you. So, you know, I think there are millions of wonderful, honest real estate folks out there, but there are some, and we all have read the stories of people that are untrustworthy. And given his record, I think Trump is one of them. I mean, you know, it's like someone says, how do you bankrupt not one, but what is it, three or four casinos?
Well, last question on politics, and then we'll talk about fun stuff. NBC News has a photograph that they occasionally use of Trump in their chyrons, their graphics. It's a profile picture, and apparently Donald Trump doesn't like it because it shows him more with a double chin. Mm-hmm. And so he has complained that they use that because he wants more flattering images. I mean, that's weird enough.
Yeah.
But how would you tell students or people who are new in the business to cover this? Anything different that you would tell them about the actual journalistic covering of this?
Well, what I've said to my students since this has begun is that we have to really focus on being as honest and as ethical as we can possibly be. That if you even remotely have a question about something, you either check it out with, you know, one of your professors, or you just don't do it, because right now he and his administration and various supporters are looking for anything to chip away at the trust, you know, in the media. And to be honest, as I've told my students and I may have said here, trust is the only thing really that journalists have for sale or to offer. The audience is trusting that what we show you, what we tell you, is as honest as humanly possible. And the idea is to try to be as unbiased as possible. That doesn't mean that your job is to make everything look great and wonderful and beautiful. Your job is to be as honest as possible. And it's like I tell my students, there is no good without bad, and there is no bad without good. So you have to be balanced, and as balanced as you can be. So again, I tell the students, you know, if you think you're getting close to the line on whatever that line may be, get away from it, because we can't afford, you know, and this may sound like I'm being cautionary. I'm not. We have to do our jobs, and we have to do them well. But if you're thinking about doing something, or something doesn't smell right, or whatever, you got to stop for a moment and really consider what you've got there.
Missteps will be exploited, for sure.
Exactly.
Yeah. Talking to William Snyder, who's won 4 Pulitzers, and in a recent conversation he had with, I love this podcast, Dad Rock. That is such a cool name. Dad Rock is such a cool name for a podcast talking about The Who. They mentioned the 4 different categories. I don't know why we've never talked about the 4 Pulitzers you've won. And look at the range of subjects you've won Pulitzers for. Inhumane treatment of orphans in Romania, National Transportation Safety Board, Barcelona Summer Olympics, and Hurricane Katrina, which you have clarified wasn't pictures that you made. You had more of an administrative role, but 4 mm-hmm. different Pulitzers. Mm-hmm. So can I ask you just real briefly, I mean, for example, inhumane treatment of orphans in Romania.
Uh-huh.
What was the story?
Well, I don't know if you remember when the curtain fell, most of the countries sort of, most of the leaders sort of stepped aside. Nicolae Ceaușescu in Romania did not. It was the only place where there was a violent overthrow. You know, they finally fought through. They got him and his wife, who was just as bad as he was, and they put him up against the wall and shot him, if I remember right. So against that background, they had their first real elections in, I can't remember if it was ever or just since the 20s. Anyway, one of the things that was discovered was that because of practices sort of and an administration that dealt in falsehoods, an administration that was focused not on the people, but on the industrial complex. What came out was that Romania had a lot of orphans. We could talk about that later if you want. But what came out was that 25% of all the orphans in that country were HIV positive. So that included infants and, you know, young people and everything. And ultimately what they discovered was that because they did not believe, or Ceaușescu said, that AIDS, HIV, was a Western decadent disease, and it did not exist in Romania, the blood supply became tainted. The medical practices in the country were not up to, you know, 90s standards, 80s standard. And because of poor nutrition, many of the orphans, especially the infants, were iron deficient. And so the only way that they really knew to take care of that was with blood transfusions. So the tainted blood supply tainted the orphans. They also didn't sterilize the needles very well between usage. And so it kind of spread like wildfire. So that was my initial thing, my initial interest when I went over there. And then ultimately what I discovered along with other people was that they had, that many of these orphanages had a lot of very, very handicapped children in them. Some of them, maybe they were born with handicaps and that's why they were given. It's my opinion, only based on observation. I have no medical background, but it's my observation that because of the neglect, because of the malnutrition, many of these orphans became handicapped mentally, physically, emotionally, because of the way they were raised in those orphanages. And those orphanages were known in many times as homes for the irrecoverables. So it sort of spread when I was there from just doing HIV orphans to just the orphanages in general. So. Mm.
So that's one Pulitzer. And then one other quick story.
Sure.
NTSB. What did you cover with NTSB?
Well, if you remember back in the 80s, Dallas had the unfortunate luck, shall we say, to see not one but 2 Deltas crash land, in Delta Air flights crash land at DFW Airport. One of them was very, very deadly. The other, fortunately, just kind of bounced off the end of the runway. Mm. So if you pay attention to the news, whenever there something like that happens, the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, conducts an investigation. And so we sort of wondered, what does that mean? And so a very enterprising reporter, David Hanners, said, I want to do this story. And they were like, okay, go see what you can. He wrote the NTSB, and they said, sure. So what they did was they allowed us to be part of an investigation team. So what we had to do was we had to wait for an unfortunate tragedy. We had to wait for a plane to go down in the region. There had to be multiple deaths. I hate to put it that way, but we wanted these things because they would more accurately reflect what we'd done.
And to be clear, obviously, you're not sitting here day by day rooting for a plane to go down.
No.
The sad reality is that you know eventually it could happen.
Yeah.
And when it does, you're ready to go cover it.
Exactly. Okay. And that's what I was referring to. I mean, it's just one of those things. And we waited, fortunately, I think it was something like 6 months. I had a beeper on. This is back in days before cell phones. I had a beeper. And New Year's Eve, 1986? Yeah, New Year's Eve, 1986, 87, I think it was, we got word. A plane had gone down in East Texas. Well, we sort of scrambled and started getting everything together, and we discovered that it was Ricky Nelson's plane. And so we couldn't do that because there was just too much news around that. So we waited again, and unfortunately, a corporate jet out of Teterboro went down again in East Texas, and it was really horrible weather involved in it. And so David and I became part of that team, and that investigation, probably because we were on part of it, they wanted to make sure they got it right before they issued their statement. It went on for almost a year, and then we put this thing together. And so it came out in 88, and we won the Pulitzer in 89. Let me say that this was the first year that they had this category, explanatory journalism. And the great part about it was, in addition to David and I, it was the first time a graphic artist had ever been involved by name with a Pulitzer. And so we're very proud of that, too, that we sort of helped put that on the map, too. With that win.
All right, see, now we know a little bit of the stories, and we're ready to talk some music. Eileen in Rochester wanted to jump in with a phone call. Go ahead, Eileen.
Okay. Hi, I just wanted to comment about the Romanian orphanages. And I think it's important to note that part of the reason that there were so many orphans was the expectation that women had at least five children.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Yeah, and the lack of a prenatal care and birth control and botched abortions because, mm-hmm. you know, people couldn't afford these children. It's really, I think, an important point to bring up when you discuss that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean,
particularly in today's climate, when we're talking about, taking away funding for places like Planned Parenthood.
You're absolutely right, and that's kind of what I was referring to. It was a horrible situation, and that was part of our coverage, too. And thank you for bringing that up. And also, you know an awful lot about this, and hats off to you. You know, the sad thing is that there's still orphanages like that exist around the world. I'm not convinced that they're entirely cleaned up in Romania, even. I know they exist in Russia. Mm-hmm. And on and on and on, because I continue to see people doing stories about these, and I have to look at the pictures. And when I look at the pictures, it looks exactly the same, and I have to read the captions and find out where these places are. They still exist. There are still governments that do these things. And you're right. In the current climate, we just need to think these things through.
My guest is four-time Pulitzer Prize winner William Snyder, who's a professor and chair of the photojournalism program at his alma mater, RIT. And RIT has a new exhibit coming up here. They've got a Friday night opening event, and then you can see the exhibit until February 25th. Where?
At Gallery R, right here in the Arts District.
100 College Avenue, I think, in Rochester.
Yes, exactly.
So Gallery R, and it's called William Snyder Picturing the Who. And so, if you want to see the exhibit, it's a great chance to kind of see, William, let's talk about the exhibit in a moment. Let's rewind a little bit, though. Because I mentioned that in 1980, you were a college intern.
Yes.
You get this great assignment. You go cover The Who. You have this great conversation with Pete for about 45 minutes, which is really cool, by the way, that Pete's talking to a college kid for 45 minutes backstage.
Yep.
But it really wasn't until 1993 that you got close with them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Tommy was on Broadway. And how did you end up making that connection there?
Well, Tommy, as you said, Tommy was on Broadway. The road show for Tommy was going to open in Dallas. And so my newspaper, the Dallas Morning News, sent me to New York to do an interview and a photo session with Pete. He and I hit it off really, really well. I was supposed to have, I think, 45 minutes with him. I ended up well over an hour talking to him. He kept sending his PA would come and knock on the door and say, you know, it's time. And he would send her away and she'd come back and he'd send her away. So we got along really well. The funny thing about that whole thing is when it was over, it was like, okay, we got to go take a picture. And he's like, what do you want to do? And I said, well, it's Tommy on Broadway. It's Pete on Broadway. So I'd like to take you out to Times Square or Broadway out in front and shoot you there. And he just gave me, as Pete is wont to do from time to time, he just cut me this look that says, and he said, I'm not doing that. And I was like,
that was the end of that.
That was the end of that. And so I was, you know, kind of flustered because, I mean, look, Pete Townsend is a rock legend. I am a huge fan of the band. And even though I know an awful lot about Pete, there are times when even people that know Pete really well, you're in his presence, he can change moods, and he did. And so I said, just rather flippantly, well, have you got any ideas? And he cut me another look, and he says, it's not my job. And I was like, okay. And so I thought about it for a minute. I said, well, can we go downstairs and shoot something on the stage and do that? And he was like, oh, okay, we can do that. So we went down, and I shot some pictures of him. They were running through Tommy. Some of the staging, I mean, as they want to do, is just, you know, the technical rehearsals that they do every time, because this was a highly technical production. And so there was great stuff on the screen, and they held some things for me, and Pete posed on one of the pinball machines and everything. And then we went out in the alley and shot a couple of things, and it went really well. We kept in touch as best we could. This was 93, so the internet and email was just getting started. But I had the ability to write to his PA and him occasionally, and, you know. So we saw each other a few times over the next couple of years. And then my life kind of changed in 95, and I kind of lost contact with him until 2000.
2000 is when, well, a lot happened. We're talking to William Snyder, whose exhibit is coming. And so I want to work through some of these great stories from the road, your stories with The Who, that I think are fascinating. But now's a good time to mention that if you want to go out Friday, is 6 to 9?
6 to 9 is the official opening. You know, it's for those of you that are art fans, you know that this Friday is First Friday. So we're hoping to see a lot of you come through. You know, we'll have a reception and come in. I want to be very clear about this. This is more than just pictures. What I'm trying to do here is give you a sense of what this whole thing is like. So there will be some multimedia. I have the actual show. The Who was kind enough to lend me the video from the show, so that will be going, and therefore the music will be playing, and I hope loudly, as long as the neighbors don't get too upset. There's other multimedia. I have original schematics for the lighting on stage. I have a time lapse that will show you, you know, from an empty stadium when there's nothing on the stage to being put up to the show running and then clearing it out. I have memorabilia. I have things. I have set lists. I have Roger Daltrey's microphone from that show. I have his tambourine from that show. I have some of Pete's strings and picks. And I have a tour booklet that you can look through and see the itinerary and all the stuff that they do there. So there's lots of things for you to see and look at and hopefully enjoy. And we have a couple of large surprises for you. So if you're into big things, you know, The Who is all about being big. And so we're trying to do that.
6 to 9, the opening reception as part of First Friday this Friday night at Gallery R in Rochester on College Avenue. And then the exhibit will be up at Gallery R until February 25th, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so a great chance to see that William Snyder picturing The Who. When we come back from our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about some of these stories from the road that that I've really enjoyed William telling me about and his chance to share with you. This is a four-time Pulitzer winner whose work around the world has covered the biggest stories, the biggest names, but he also became kind of, fair to say, the personal photographer, though? I don't know. The band photographer.
I hesitate saying that because there have been other photographers that have been working with them over the years.
How many let you on stage? How many photographers did they let on stage?
Not many. And now I'm really the only one. You know, they even on their website they said, you know, our official photographer, but I kind of cringe at that, you know.
So coming up, we're going to talk about a flight that a set of circumstances in which William says that's when he knew he was sort of in with the band. You're going to hear some of what the band says about William. And we have that audio. We do.
Oh, great.
And also want to talk about, you know, a more serious note. I mean, this is a band that is known for its everything is big, as William said, and so was the partying. So was some of the substance abuse, and they've lost, you know, you lose some people over the years. There was a poignant conversation from 2000. We'll talk about a lot of that stuff with William Snyder after this short break. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, more people are surviving violence because of better trauma care. You might have seen the story in the Democrat and Chronicle. We'll talk to the reporter who wrote the story and leaders in the medical community about the impact on Rochester. Then second hour, journalist and photographer Chris Arnotti joins us. He's become kind of the voice of forgotten voters in America, and a controversial one. We'll talk about his work on the road. I could probably just listen to this for the rest of the hour if, you know. And this is long track. I think it's like an 8-minute track or something.
No, Bob is only about five minutes long.
Eminence Front's 8 minutes. That's what I was thinking of.
I don't even know when. Won't Get Fooled Again is 8.5, 9 minutes, depending upon how they draw it out.
You would know this, so. But no, yeah. Bob is awesome. This is
Bob is great. I mean, as a kid, when I heard this in high school, that was it. I heard
right
this.
There when it kicks into?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We used to have these parties and at my house and other people's houses, and this would come on and we would start jumping around.
Oh, yeah.
Because we knew that's what they were doing. So it was, I love this song. I love that album. Who's Next?
I mean, it's so good. It's just
And then of course, as a kid, you know, it's about teenage wasteland, you know, and as Pete says, you know, it's actually an awful story about, you know, kids getting off course, as it were. But a little side note for, you know, casual fans, this was part, the whole Who's Next album was part of an aborted attempt to follow Tommy with something even bigger and better. Something so sort of crazy that it almost drove Pete crazy. The interesting thing about it was it dealt with the grid and how people would be connected with each other and how you could have virtual reality experiences and all of that stuff. And Pete was writing about this in 1971, 72. And so I find that really interesting and prophetic. But it was this big project that even to this day I kind of don't understand. Elements of the Matrix sort of fit in with it because we're talking about alternate realities.
What?
And things like that. Yeah, I asked Pete if he'd seen The Matrix when it came out, and he was like, no, I haven't. I said, well, it looks like you kind of inspired it. So it was really pretty interesting. But anyway, it was a really amazing project, which kind of brings us up to what you want to talk about, I think, how I got back together with him. So Pete sort of put this Lifehouse project, that's what he called it.
When was this?
In 2000. 99, he was working on it, and in 2000. Now, understand that he, over the years, he continued to sort of try to put it together. So Who Are You? Slip Kid. and a few other things that he wrote later were also supposed to be part of this. And so what he did in 99, he kind of put it all together, and in 2000 he had this concert, these two concerts in London with I think it was the London Symphony or London Philharmonic or something, with an orchestra and a full band, and they played all of this stuff from beginning to end. And it's really quite a remarkable piece of work. And so I was aware of that because of his website. I got the newspaper to again send me to London to do a story and photos about this. And it just so happens I also managed to get into a small little sort of fan press conference that he had. At that point, we were sort of staring. I noticed he was sort of staring at me. And then after the first night, there was a party afterwards, and he was there. And I walked up to him and, you know, stuck my hand out and reintroduced myself. And he says, "Oh, yeah, I thought I recognized you. How have you been?" And it started again. So we reconnected. I ended up with his email address, and so we kept in touch via email there for a while. Later that year, The Who reunited, shall we say, and called themselves The Who. Yes, they'd been out before, but they never really called themselves The Who. But it was a stripped-down band. It was Pete, Roger, John Entwistle, who was still alive, Zach Starkey, Ringo's son, and John Rabbit Bundrick, who some people may know or maybe not, but he was on Bob Marley's first album, and in many ways he's sort of responsible for helping Bob Marley sort of integrate the reggae with sort of, you know, American white or northern music or whatever.
Pop music.
Mm-hmm. And so they went out as a five-piece band, and they were great and they were hard, and they started the tour in Chicago. Again, I got the paper to send me, and I went up to Chicago and shot it and sent some things in the paper. And Pete, on his website, he says, you know, on this tour, I'm going to have pictures, and I'm going to have videos, and I'm going to have all this stuff in a diary. So I went and looked at the website the next day, and there was nothing there. And I thought, okay. So I thought, rather presumptuous of me, I'll go and I'll visit Pete at his hotel.
In Chicago.
And so I went down there, and I tried calling his room, and he didn't answer the phone. And I thought, you know, this is really ridiculous. This is almost stalkerish. Why am I doing this? So this was a hotel who had a motor lobby on the first floor and then a regular lobby. So I left the regular lobby, went downstairs, and it was one of those things where it's sort of, you know, you want to talk about kismet, fate, whatever. I walked out of the lobby into this, you know, driveway. I could have gone right or I could have gone left. I went left, and as I turned left, it was backlit, but there's no mistaking his figure, and there Pete was. So I walked up to him and said, "Hey, Pete," and at first he was like sort of startled because he couldn't see who I was. "Oh, how are you?" And I, you know, we talked a little bit, and I said, "Listen, I saw your website. There's nothing on there. You know, listen, if you ever need any help, let me know. I'm happy to, you know, come and do anything." And we talked a little bit, and he said, "Well, we're going to Detroit tonight. Do you, you know, you want to come there?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm not flying, and I'm, you know, got a car." And he says, "Well, maybe there's room for you on the plane."
Get on the band's plane.
And I was like, "Well, okay." And so I gave him my card, and he said, "You know, somebody will call you." So probably at this point, I'm in downtown Chicago, and it's like, okay, I could either drive to Detroit and do this, or I'm going to, you know. So I'd already checked out of my hotel, so I'm sort of, I wouldn't say frantically, but sort of driving around town just killing time and, you know, what do I do? And it was really kind of stupid, but, I mean, it was exciting. And so, sure enough, his PA called me and said, "All right, there's a seat for you on the plane." And I said, "Is there one for me to come back?" And he says, and she said, "Yeah, absolutely." And I said, "Okay, where do I?" And so they said, "Come out to Midway and meet us here." And so I got on the plane, and, you know, and the first thing I said was, you know, "Can I shoot pictures on the plane?" And he was like, "Yeah." So I have pictures from that first plane flight, and, you know, and everything kind of fell into place after that.
And how many times have you shot the band since then? 50, 60?
Yeah, something in that. I've lost track.
All right, so that's why I said you're not the personal photographer of the band, but kind of. And so, and you ended up spending a lot of time with them, obviously, and having some pretty serious conversations. I mean, as you mentioned, I was asking William last night, you know, how the band has changed over the years. There's a lot that, I mean, they still play the songs, and some bands age better than others, and I think The Who has aged very well. But they don't have the same sort of substance intake, drugs and rock and roll. But even back then in 2000, there were some band members going pretty hard, and that worried you, didn't it?
Well, there was, I mean, you know, the original three. And just background for those of you who don't know, Keith Moon died of an overdose, ironically, of a drug that he was taking to help him get off of alcohol. Mm. So that was sort of tragic. So the people that were left were John Entwistle, the bass player, Pete Townsend, the guitarist, and Roger Daltrey, lead vocals, and now rhythm guitar, too. And in 2000, I mean, you know, they were in their, mid-50s, I think it was. And John was partying very, very hard. I mean, very hard. I ran into him several times on that tour because I shot probably, I don't know, nine shows, maybe even more. I went to Southern California with them. I did a big their big stand at the Madison Square Garden. Shot him in Dallas, Houston, you know, and a few other places. But every time I saw John after the show, it was clear that he'd been doing a lot of stuff. And it really kind of worried me. I care about these people. I wasn't, you know, I really didn't have any kind of relationship with John. My relationship was more with Pete and then ultimately with Roger. And so one day in New York, I was having a conversation with Pete, and I finally sort of screwed up the courage, and I said, Pete, you know, I'm really worried about John. And he says, what do you mean? And I said, I think he may be the next one that we bury, and it's going to be pretty soon. And he says, what are you talking about? And I said, well, I've seen him out several times, and he is partying really hard, especially for a man of his age and, you know, and all of that, and I'm just concerned. So Pete said, well, you should go talk to Bill about this. And I said, Bill Kerbishley, your manager? And he's like, well, yeah, he'll listen to you. And I said, come on, Pete, really? I mean, me? And he said, no, go talk to him about it. So, again, I screwed up. And Bill, you have to understand, Bill is a great guy, but he can be very scary. Bill is an old East Ender from London and, you know, was a hard case when he was a young man. And so Bill, he's not like Pete, but I wouldn't want to make Bill mad. And so I screwed up the courage and went to Bill and said, listen, I'm here because Pete suggested I talk to you. And I told him the same thing. And he said, you know, we can only do what we can do. He's a grown man. We can't force him to do something that he doesn't want to do. We can kind of watch him, but that's about it. And that was in, I guess, late 2000, mid-late 2000. And, you know, as many people know, he famously died in 2002 in Las Vegas at the Hard Rock Cafe with substances in the room and a professional woman of the night. So he lived the rock and roll life, and he went out the rock and roll life.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. Talking to William Snyder, who has photographed The Who first time in 1980, but really picked up in the year 2000 many times over the years. The exhibit that is launching on Friday night is Picturing The Who, and I want to just listen to a little bit of what the band says about William. So credit where it's due. William was on a podcast called Dad Rock, which, again, it's a great name for a podcast about rock and roll, the music your father probably liked, or if you're a dad, or if you're a grandfather.
If you're a dad, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they were talking about his work photographing The Who, and they had dug up some audio of the band talking about William. I thought this was pretty cool, so let's listen.
In Dallas, he's a very good friend of mine. I've been running a website through the tour, and some of you will have seen the photographs of a very good friend of mine who works for the Post or the News here, Dallas Morning, something or other. Dallas Morning News, I think it is. His name is William Snyder. And he's taken lots of video for me and lots of pictures for me, which I put up on my website. And yesterday I was editing footage of that he shot of fans. And this gentleman down here got William's name wrong. And so I've got you on the website going, "Oh, I'm sorry, William." Because I think you like you, and you said, well, some other call you Bill. And of course, I called him Bill for ages before I realized that he liked to be called William. William. He's William Snyder, and he's here tonight, so give William a big hand. I'd like to find him, by the way. He's been such a friend on this tour, shooting video, taking some great photographs.
So that was pretty nice.
Yes. In front of the hometown crowd. Yeah, it was really very, very nice of Pete to do it. It was exhilarating and embarrassing too. But, you know, I think that everybody that's out there that is a fan, is a music fan, and has fallen in love with a band or a musician or something, sort of actually dreams of something like that happening to them when they go to a concert. And so, you know, I thought it was just amazing. Now, let's put this in perspective. My youngest son at that point was, I don't know, this was in 2000, so he was 9 years old. There were friends of ours in the same row with us. It was just happenstance. And so he was there. He doesn't like loud noises. And so this friend of ours leans over to him and sort of says, "Hey, he's talking about your dad up there." And so my son just kind of goes, yeah, you know, that's dad's friend Pete. And just sort of, you know, takes all the air out of everything.
as kids do.
Are want to do.
Yes.
But, you know, it was wonderful. And I caught a lot of grief from everybody on the tour after that, because he did the whole thing about Bill versus William.
It's okay. I've done that too. So,
yeah, well, that's okay.
William is a William.
That's right. William is a William. Let me also say something about the exhibit here too. The other thing I want to be clear is that this is not a retrospective of my career shooting The Who. What this is focused on one show.
May of last year, right?
May of last year. And the reason I did that is because I have such a wide variety of things. Again, some of the other stuff that I have is, you know, one of the things that these guys have to do is they do these meet and greets. And fans, everybody loves that. But it's usually before the show, you know, within an hour before the show goes on. And they're, you know, they like meeting their fans, but people fumble with cameras and everything. And that was one reason this tour, in addition to the show, they just said, "Look, we want you to run this thing." So I put up a backdrop and run the people through Pete and Roger pretty quickly. They get a chance. And so the pictures that I made are in there, and it's a contact sheet. And you get a chance to see how goofy some of these people are, how goofy Pete and Roger can be. So there's that. And then the other thing that was really cool about this show was a couple of days before the show, Zach Starkey, the drummer, came up to him, and he goes, "Hey, William, can you come and shoot some pictures? I'm having a party, you know, a get-together before the show, and can you shoot pictures? And there'll be a lot of people there, and my dad will be there, and, you know, and it'll be, you know." And I was like, "Yeah, sure, anything you want, Zach." And so I didn't think anything about it. And so the day of the show, I was there really early. And then when they showed up for the sound check, I was like, "Okay, now, Zach, what have you got and what's going on?" He says, "Well, you know, I have a lot of people coming and I'd like to get pictures of as many as I can. And my dad will be there. And so, you know, it's important to get pictures of him and everything." And all of a sudden it dawned on me who his dad was. Now, those of you out there may already know this, but if you recognize the name Starkey, Zach's dad is Ringo. So I got a chance to shoot Ringo and meet him. And
does Ringo Starkey, does he know Ringo Starr? Same guy.
Same. But it was, you know, it's one of those things that was a lot of fun. And then, you know, whenever they perform in L.A. or New York, lots of people kind of come out. And so there's quite a few people In the photos. So it'll be interesting for people to see.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about craft before we lose the hour here.
Okay.
I asked you on the phone last night, and I'd love for you to tell me a little bit how you feel about this. We've talked to bands about how they feel that everyone in the audience has a cell phone, a smartphone, a camera.
Yeah.
And some bands like it and some don't.
Yeah.
Some feel like you're not even paying attention to me anymore. Everything's got to be on a video. Can't you be in the moment? Well, you as a photographer, I don't know if you're competing against them, but they have the opportunity to capture images now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked you, you know, does that bother you? You gave an interesting answer. You said no, because in many ways you feel like that drives you to be better and more creative.
Yeah, because, you know, they can do things now that, you know, when I shot them in 1980, I could barely do with great, you know, professional gear. Now everything's automatic and the quality is really high. And I agree with them that too many people spend too much time recording and aren't in the moment. But I also understand that desire to have those memories. It does. It forces me to get out of that sort of onstage paradigm. And I talk to my students about this. Plus the WHO stage and show has changed over the last decade. So the stage is a lot more wide open. So there are fewer places for me to sort of hide up on the stage. There are few places that are left, they now have baffles around Pete's gear that sort of help keep the sound level and the high frequencies down to where, you know, it's comfortable on stage. For those of you who don't know, nowadays, you know, the stages are actually pretty quiet. Most everybody uses in-ear monitors. You'll see that. Pete doesn't. Pete uses the wedge monitors, you know, at his feet. And, you know, and then he can hear the drums and the whole nine yards. So there's not a lot of places for me to hide. So what I end up having to do is use a lot of remote cameras mounted on the stage, over the stage, the side of the stage, and all of that. And then look for different things, just little moments between Pete and Roger or between Pete and Zach. That's a little harder to do because now they've got a plexi screen around him to help cut the sound down. But you know, there are things still to be had, and access helps. It really helps because the stuff that you get down front, you know, unless you're looking for specific things, and occasionally I am, you're going to end up with very similar things to what those people out in the crowd get.
I asked you, and this is another interesting answer to me. I said, you know, you, as a Pulitzer winner who's shot presidents and political figures and big world events and natural disasters, what's different about shooting a great rock band?
Well, I mean, as far as shooting is concerned, not really anything because it's constantly moving. It's constantly changing. Even if you know the show, these guys are unpredictable. You don't know exactly what they're going to do. So there's that just like anything else. But, you know, I love this band. I love this music. And so part of it is to you know, I have to force myself sometimes to, oh, I'm here to take pictures, not to just watch and listen to the music. And that's the big difference for me. This is a labor of love. At some point, I hope to put out a book. I haven't really figured out how to do that yet. But, you know, compared to everything else, I mean, I've shot a lot of events and a lot of things over and over and over again because I had to, because I sort of enjoyed it, but I eventually got burned out. I've shot The Who, like I said, over 50 times, maybe more. I mean, on the last tour, I think it was over a dozen times. And I'll go shoot them again. They're coming back. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all I know is that they're coming back, and it's going to be a lot of fun, and it's going to be really interesting. And I'll be out there with him again.
Angela wants to know, what does he shoot on?
Well, digital cameras, digital SLRs, mostly Canon. I am fortunate enough at Dallas Morning News, at the Rochester Institute of Technology, that we have access to a lot of different gear. So I play and experiment. I've shot with Sonys. I've shot with Leicas. I've shot with Nikons. just whatever is going to work for what I'm doing.
Matt says, I want his job. How do I get it?
It's like everything else. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice.
William Snyder has been my guest for the hour, four-time Pulitzer winner who has photographed The Who so many times. And there's one show in particular at the Forum in L.A., right?
Correct.
No, sorry. The Staples Center?
All right. You're right.
I'm the still stuck Center. On the old.
That's right. That's right.
Man,
me
I
too.
Went back in time there. For a
well,
second.
You know, I think the Forum still has shows and actually some of the
Wait,
people.
Wait, is the Forum still... Is it still there?
Maybe it's the Forum. I think it's the Forum. Maybe I'm wrong.
But, I don't know.
But the guys were telling me there's one venue there that they love because they can drive the semis right into the arena and load them right there.
All right. So the Staples Center last May, and it's William Snyder Picturing the Who. You can check it out at the opening gallery event. The reception is this Friday, 6 to 9 p.m. at Gallery R in Rochester. Lots of cool stuff there, and that's during First Friday. That's out. Gallery R is on College Avenue in Rochester. Can't get out on Friday. You can check out the exhibit between Friday and February 25th. And it's been a lot of fun. I hope you have a lot of fun with it.
I've had a lot of fun with this, and I'm having a lot of fun. Of course, you know, I'm a little anxious getting everything to come together the way I want it to be, but it's great. This is one of those things you dream about.
And last quick thing here.
Sure.
You have like roadies notes, set lists, stuff like that?
Yeah, I have roadies notes for Pete's stuff, for Zach, set lists, all kinds of memorabilia and things for you to look at in addition to just pictures.
Have fun with that. Thanks for being here. And I know we'll talk to you about other journalistic stuff, as we often do. He is the chair of the Department of the Photojournalism Program. He's an RIT professor. He's an RIT grad.
Yep.
And great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Evan. I appreciate it.
A little Who music for us to finish. John Andrews, engineer, thank you. And Megan Mack, producer, always the best. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll talk to you tomorrow.